took place in the safety and liberalism of you know, countries like Canada, the United States, and Western Europe. You know, the we know about some of the personal growth movements that developed, like Landmark Forum and the Tantra movement, which is an incorporation of some Eastern philosophies. So a lot of Westerners started to experiment with spiritual practices, which were far, far from rationality-based. They were more spiritual-based, emotion-based, right? Emotional and spiritual practices displaced a lot of intellect and rationality. Paradoxically, in societies where people had freedom, in liberal democracies, which were in many ways based on rationality. So it's a very complex, multi-layered situation, and I'm not sure that we could say that there's this pull. These are polar opposites, right? Emotions versus rationality. And as people move away from the emotion pull toward the rationality pull, that's progress. It seems like an oversimplification to me.
I do think that the ideal that Comte laid out in the end of this, in a system of positive polity, so he envisions a socialist society governed by a few unelected officials who in turn are educated and advised by an elite priesthood of social scientists. I don't think that is the ideal society that people envision today. I think that it flies in the face of the ideas of liberal democracy. So, I think that's important to note. The article did note that as well, but let's just keep things moving. John Stuart Mill is our next thinker, 1806 to 1873. Comte's contemporary, admired his progressive philosophy of history and shared his respect for scientific expertise. But Mill was disappointed by Comte's basic distaste for democratic freedom and individuality. Unlike Comte, Mill thought that a strong, scientifically oriented society could be a liberal democracy. Such a society would best maintain the gains already achieved and nurture further improvement. Mill articulates his twin commitment to progress and liberal democracy in his major writings, including A System of Logic, 1843, Utilitarianism, 1861, On Liberty, 1859, On Representative Government, 1861. Mill's writings effectively establish connections among utility, liberty, and political institutions. Like his father, James Mill, and Jeremy Bentham, Mill is a utilitarian. Utility, or aggregate pleasure, provides the ultimate standard for comparing two historical eras or contemporaneous societies. The claim that humanity is progressing means that utility is increasing over time. Then a system of logic, Mill following Comte, argues that the development of ideas drives the development of society as a whole. Finally, in On Liberty and On Representative Government, Mill considers how a society's institutions can slow or accelerate ideological development. So I think probably the main difference between our modern ideas of progress and these ideas in the 19th century are perhaps the idea that perhaps the role or the central role of intellectual development in creating better progress. I don't think that if you said that, you know, it's the sociologists who will, you know, unlock the secrets of creating a perfect society, I don't think that's where we're currently stand. I think that people believe that sociologists still have a role in helping society function, but the idea that a small number of them, as Comte suggested, should be in charge of society at its head in an unelected capacity is not one that we currently you'd find a lot of support for, I think. It seems that some of John Stuart Mill's ideas of committing to the ideas of liberal democracy would have much more support. However, the utilitarian framework of taking utility as the metric by whether or not we know humanity is progressing, that could potentially have some problems and be in need of criticism. And I think that may be something worth exploring in the future. All right.
Yeah, concept of liberal democracy has come up a lot in the last few minutes or half an hour, right, of our discussion. But I think that many political scientists today acknowledge that liberal democracy is on the retreat in much of the world. Many examples in many countries where liberal democracies of one degree or another have been displaced by authoritarianism and continue to be threatened by authoritarianism. And so if liberal democracy is considered progress or the movement toward liberal democracy, then are we to say then that we are now regressing in the world to a great extent rather than progressing? Not everyone would agree with that, right? Some people would say that liberal democracy is a flawed idea. And, I mean, you know, the thing is that a lot of, the authoritarians now that are displacing or supplanting liberal democracies were elected. They were elected in liberal democracies. There's a real irony there. So the voters who elected those leaders who are dismantling the liberal democracies and creating more of an authoritarian society, those voters probably would not acknowledge that they've voted against progress. They just see progress as something different.
It's an interesting question to think about how you strengthen a democratic system, or what makes a strong democratic system. Do you want something like a direct democracy where individuals can essentially say, well, you know, I think we should vote on this, and so we have to now vote on this? Or is a representative democratic system, which, you know, we have in Canada and the United States, is that a better, more stable option? I think that considering cultural context and historical background are useful when thinking about which political system is best for a given society or what implementation of democracy, perhaps. But I think you're definitely right that democracy can be said to have been declining around the world in some respects. I think it's also worth saying that democracy, generally speaking, is a very difficult political system to create. That there have been many attempts to create republics or democratic countries that have failed for a variety of reasons. And it's difficult to say that every country, even if, for instance, progress towards a liberal democratic tradition was good in most countries, if we took that to be progress, it's difficult to say whether or not that is instantaneously possible, or if, you know, we might need some intermediate steps. It's a difficult question. The Republic in France, for instance, is on their fifth republic at this moment. England is still a constitutional monarchy still, but yet has a robust parliamentary system. So, and then of course there's the United States, which some people argue its system could be revised in some respects, and other people argue that it needs to remain strong and true to its founding principles. So it's, even if we accept that liberal democracy and the movement towards liberal democracy is progress, then we get into the question of, is it subjective in terms of what kind of democracy we should look for, or what types of transitions are likely to create successful democracies. So that is an interesting question, which goes a little bit off topic, but I think it does bring to the forefront this idea of utility. And whether even if a group of people all find admiration for the ideal of utility and democracy, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll be able to create their own successful democracy instantaneously, given present circumstances.
There's also the problem of human nature. And, you know, we can question whether the ideal of democracy is attainable long-term, whether it's stable, considering human nature. So let me give you an example. Think about a intersection of two roads with the intersection is controlled with, let's say, stop signs. So everyone has a stop sign. It's a four-way stop, they call it. Well, there's going to be some people who take advantage of the fact that other people are obeying the rules and stopping to blow right through the intersection, to not stop. And they can get away with that because everyone else's, or most other people, are obeying the rules. The same thing's even true at any intersection with controlled with lights, right? So people that run yellow lights, you know, that gun it right when the light turns yellow, or they even run the red lights, get away with it most of the time because most of the other people stopped, right? So so my point is that perhaps that's the human condition, that's human nature, is that some people are going to obey the rules and other people are going to take advantage of the fact that other people are obeying the rules. If so, then that would seem to be a problem for the idea of equality, because as soon as you set up a egalitarian society or a liberal society or a democratic society, that's going to create the opening for a few people, a minority of people, to take advantage of the fact that other people are cooperative to seek power and wealth for themselves, and to then change the rules once they get enough power to do that. And maybe that's what we see happening now in countries like Turkey and Hungary and Russia and perhaps even in the United States. You see a movement by a minority of people to take advantage of the fact that there is a free society set up, an open society, a democratic society set up. So maybe, sort of as Plato predicted, maybe democracy is simply not a stable system, and therefore it'd be hard to measure progress by the degree to which humanity moves away from their own instinctual behavior.
I think that's an interesting counterpoint. I do think that Mill has something to say directly to respond to that, so I'll keep reading a bit more of this. Mill thinks that it is impossible to find a single set of institutions that is progressive for all times and places. The most we can do is to specify what institutions are best for societies at a given level of civilization. Mill controversially argues that despotic governments may push barbarians to the next level of civilization, but Mill argues that in more advanced societies, free institutions promote further progress. They do so by allowing ideological conflict, which is a powerful engine of ideological development. Mill worries about the transition from one set of institutions to another. Civilizations can reach a certain level of development and then stagnate because they do not undergo institutional change. Despite his reputation as a classic Victorian progressive, Mill is more cautious and less deterministic than other 19th century writers treated by this essay. He believes that continued improvement is possible, but is not by any means inevitable. Progress in Europe will likely come to a halt if institutions silence society's creative members. Mill's works derive their urgency from the fact that he clearly thinks that they can make a real difference. On Liberty focuses on the argument for government non-interference. on representative government deals with some of the ways the democratic institutions could be reformed to promote different views, different points of view actively. A fellow Victorian philosopher, Herbert Spencer, is much more deterministic than Mill. Spencer views human progress as one aspect of a universe in perpetual development. Spencer constructs his explanatory framework from materials from the biological sciences. He is keenly interested in the theories of biological evolution, both Lamarckian and then Darwin. So you mentioned earlier the question of human nature, and it's interesting to consider here that if some people believe that progress is human nature, then it is inevitable, and others believe that progress is not necessarily part of human nature. It's something that we have to work at or discover, perhaps through instruments such as social or democratic institutions. So that's another interesting question. Understanding Spencer's theoretical orientation requires some background in 19th century biology. Darwin's theory of evolution was not the first modern attempt to account for the diversity of life on the planet without invoking an act of divine creation. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck explained the apparent match between each animal species and its environment by positing that individual animals could acquire and pass on adaptive characteristics. This explanation requires, first of all, that animals strive to adapt to their environment. Second, it requires that animals change physically as a result of their efforts. And third, they pass on their required characteristics to their offspring. In contrast, Darwin hypothesized that randomly occurring variation among individual organisms could be preserved or destroyed in the population of organisms through differential reproductive success. That is, he conjectured that some characteristics are correlated with the ability to produce a greater number of offspring. These characteristics will tend to increase in a population over time. Darwin called this mechanism natural selection. Natural selection bypasses the problematic assumption that individual organisms could alter themselves through deliberate effort. Yet it can still explain why organisms seem to fit into their natural environment so well. In Social Statics, Spencer asserts that evil is never permanent. He reasons to this conclusion from two premises. First, he defines evil as non-adaptive constitution to conditions. Second, he claims that all living beings gradually fit into their environment. He lists a great number of natural phenomena that supposedly illustrate this law. At the point of writing, Spencer was a Lamarckian, but he later maintained that essentially this argument as a proponent of Darwinism. Evil in the human sense exists because human beings, by virtue of their selfishness, are unsuited to social living. By this variety of evil, like all evil, will pass away as humans adapt to their circumstances. He defines progress as the evolution of humans from selfishness to selflessness. In Progress, Its Law and Cause, Spencer makes a different argument. He defines progress as an advance from homogeneity of structure to heterogeneity of structure. Progress occurs by way of successive differentiations. The law of progress is simply that every active force produces more than one change. Every cause produces more than one effect. Spencer claims that all phenomena exhibit the same development from its simple to complex for the same reason. He finds evidence for progress in astronomy and linguistics. The modern literature on progress generally argues that European science, culture, and institutions are the best in the world at the time the author is writing, but claims or insinuations that Europeans are biologically superior are rare. Turgot, as we have seen, states that individual genius occurs as frequently among non-Europeans as among Europeans, nor do Mill's claims that European superiority rest on biological arguments. In other words, the paradigmatic progress narrative shows Europeans setting the standards and then the rest of the world catching up until everyone is a full participant in an enlightened order. The introduction of biological evolution into writings on progress enabled a new form of Eurocentrism, one founded on biological racism. Spencer enlists evolutionary theory to claim that different races of human beings exist and form a clear hierarchy. the civilized man departs more widely from the general type of the placental mammalia than do the lower races. This includes mental characteristics. Judging from the greater extent and variety of faculty he exhibits, we may infer that the civilized man has also a more complex or heterogeneous nervous system than the uncivilized man." End quote. Spencer's racism is central to his view that humans as a group and of human potential. Ultimately, it calls into question whether he can be said to truly propose an account of progress. So, we have covered a lot of ground in this show and discussed ideas from at least 5 different thinkers, and all of them, I think we could say, have some elements that we today see major problems with, to put it mildly. The search for an ideal of progress is not without danger. It's not without problems. In fact, it's difficult to say if we could say that there is any united ideal of progress among these thinkers. You could definitely argue, and I think argue correctly, that their ways of thinking are distinct, and progress is distinct to each one of their ways of thinking, and that many aspects of their thinking cannot be compared or rectified. Like, you'd have to choose one of their modes of thinking over another.
You know how they say that history is written by the victors of wars? They get to write the history. I think what we're seeing here is that culture developed in a particular part of the world, Europe, which adopted values which were very unique and had previously been minor, you know, or even unknown in the world. And the values were having to do with colonialism, expansionism. You can see that in Christian religious thinking about the idea of salvation, original sin, how people needed to be saved from their destiny of the fiery pits of hell. And it was therefore incumbent upon Christian Europeans to colonize the world and convert the natives to save them from hell. That was a very peculiar way of thinking that developed in Europe. And so the Europeans expanded and colonialized much of the world, most of the world, all the world, maybe little pockets of holdouts right now. And they get to write the rules. They get to write the history books. They get to write the, what you just described, Aaron. They get to write the philosophy there, the metaphysics about it's Europeans that lead the way, either because they're biologically superior, or if you don't accept that, certainly they're intellectually superior, and certainly European ideas are superior. And so progress is being led by the Europeans. That's great, except for perhaps if we get a bigger view of time, it'll turn out that Europeans, with all of the progress, all of our European progress and our scientific knowledge and our industrial and technological developments, we're leading the world straight off of a cliff into annihilation because of environmental destruction. So the big picture might wind up showing that what European culture, what European society defines as progress, as leading the way, turns out to be jumping off a cliff. And it was the Europeans that took humanity off the cliff, which is probably not at all progress. I'm just being the skeptic here, that's all.
I think that might go a little bit too far, but I can definitely see some of what you're saying there. I think that what everyone could kind of see from going through this show is that when we were looking at Kant's idea, to some degree, if we go all the way back to thinkers like Thomas More with his idea of utopia, and when we were talking about Hobbes, I almost think that their vaguer notions were a little bit easier to cope with in terms of, well, you know, I don't really agree with this idea of progress, but I might be able to investigate it and incorporate some of its elements into a modern conception of progress. Whereas these, a lot of these narratives seem to conflict with our ideals of progress. And I think a lot of that comes from lessons that we've learned the hard and horrific way in the 20th century. So on our next show, we'll be talking specifically of criticisms of ideas of progress. And that's not just from the ideas on the 19th century, but, and then after that, we'll be discussing ideas from the 20th century. So I think what was very interesting to me, especially, is to think about that many of the ideas that I've learned in history that I consider problematic that have arisen in the 20th century have their origin in some of these 19th century ideas. And that leads us to the ever popular maxim that ideas have consequences. So I suppose you could say from the negative sense, at least, intellectual development, intellectual ideas are very important, if only because they can cause great problems for society when misused. On that note, you have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang. Today I've been joined by Michael Robert Kaditz. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you join us next time.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
Food security in your community. This holiday season, we're thrilled to announce that the SFU Community Free Fridge is available to staff, students, and faculty. The fridge is conveniently located on the first level of the Student Union Building on Burnaby Campus. We encourage all our community members to enjoy the fridge, or better yet, volunteer with friends to clean and stock it. Thank you to the organizations who made this initiative possible, including the SFSS, Embark Sustainability, the Burnaby Primary Care Network, Food Mesh, Burnaby Neighborhood House, SFU Ancillary Services, and SFU's Office of Community Engagement. Visit sfss.ca/news and follow at Burnaby Fridge on Instagram to find out more.
From March 6th to March 10th, Art Week is happening at SFU Combo Mall. Each day, a different event will be running, so you could enjoy arts and science for the entire week. The Faculty of Art and Social Science Department Student Union presents the week event. This is a good opportunity to meet with the past students. The event week is happening from March 6th to March 10th at the SFU Combo Mall. For more information, visit the SFU event page.